I would have you to turn this morning then to Ruth chapter 2, if you would, please, and we'll continue with our examination of this little book, and particularly of chapter 2. You remember I said a couple of weeks ago that I entitled this chapter, Ruth is Introduced to Boaz, and that title actually works as a way of dividing the chapter. It depends on how you emphasize it, okay? So you take this phrase, Ruth is introduced to Boaz, and emphasize a certain part of it, and you get an understanding of the breakdown of the book. At the beginning of the chapter, Ruth is introduced to Boaz, okay? So Boaz is introduced to this person. Ruth comes to this field. She happens to come to this particular field, and Boaz comes there while the harvest is taking place, and he notices her. He is introduced to her. He asks, who is this woman? Whose woman is this? He asks. So the first part is his introduction to her. But then, if you could turn it around and emphasize Ruth then. Ruth is introduced to Boaz. In the second part, which we looked at last week, we see the character of Boaz and who he is as a man be introduced to Ruth. She gets to understand him now. She is introduced to him in terms of who he is as a man who the writer tells us is a worthy man, you remember. Worthy, I think, not only because he's wealthy in the sense of a landowner, but also worthy because he demonstrates his character as kind, generous, and he certainly was in granting to Ruth the opportunity to glean ahead of the other gleaners and to go in places where gleaners wouldn't normally be allowed to go in order to collect food. So the first two parts of these three parts are an introduction to Boaz and an introduction to Ruth. But there's now a second introduction to Ruth. Ruth is introduced a second time to Boaz in the final section of this chapter. You remember I said it could also be broken down by the main characters in the story. The beginning is Ruth, the middle is Boaz, and now we turn back to Naomi at the end of the chapter. So we're going to continue doing what we've been doing along. We're going to work through the storyline verse by verse, and we're going to discuss along the way certain theological realities that appear. Like I said, it's sort of a running commentary on the passage. The passage, you remember, the theological concept that comes out first is the providence of God, his work in time and space such that his sovereign will is accomplished, his involvement in the world in such a way that events lead to his desired outcome. We know the outcome of this book is ultimately for the grandfather of David to be revealed, and so the providence of God is such for the events to lead eventually to that particular place. It is the providence of God that Ruth makes it to that particular field. It's the providence of God that Boaz comes there while she's there and so on. God is clearly at work behind the scenes making these things happen. But we also saw, as we talked about last week, the reality of God's kindness as well. The theological concept of God's nature such that he acts in ways that bring about good in the life of the individual. Now that good is defined not by how we might want to define it, but rather how it's defined by him in terms of his goals in that individual. Even when his kindness appears to us to be difficult for us, it is still a kindness because it is leading to a goal, a purpose, an end, a desire that he has in all things. And so we have providence on the one hand and kindness on the other. And this morning we're going to address another aspect of the character of God. And we're going to see it as the combination of providence and kindness as the chapter concludes. All right, so now we get to verses 17 to 23. So let's just start reading just in verses 17 and 18, and we'll begin making our commentaries there. So she gleaned in the field. That is, so Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley, and she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her, that is, Ruth also brought out and gave Naomi what food she had left over after being satisfied. Okay, so let's just stop there and make some comments. Now, if you look closely, you'll notice that this entire chapter occurs in a day. It's a single day, from the beginning to the end of the chapter. Okay, it's the very first day, I think, it's the very first day that Ruth actually goes out to glean. Now, it might not be. I mean, it's not specific, but it certainly seems reasonable that as soon as Ruth and Naomi make it to Bethlehem, the very next day they would have to deal with the issue of, well, we're going to need something to eat, so let's go and take care of the matter. So it seems reasonable to me that this is the very first day that Ruth goes to glean. It says she works until evening. In Jewish reckoning, that would be until sundown or until the reapers end their day. Because she, remember, she's following around the reaper, so if they leave the field, she would be leaving with them. So as she works through this day, she beats out, it says, what she had gleaned. Now, for a gleaner, a person collecting the leftovers in the field, the process of separating the kernels of grain she had collected from the full heads would be this process of beating out. She's got some kernels just laying there in her basket, but she's also got heads that she's got to beat out. So it's sort of like a simplified version of threshing. She's got to beat out the grain that she needs. Okay. So that's really all I think that means. And it says she collects about an ephah. About an ephah. Now an ephah, if you look at the ESV note, if you're using an ESV, there's a note at the bottom. It says that this measures around 3/5 of a bushel. Around 3/5 of a bushel. If you Google that, it comes up to about 20 dry quarts. So imagine 20 quart jars filled with grain. That's about how much that is. Okay. I went looking this week on Wednesday. As of Wednesday, October 2nd, U.S. number one malt barley on the Montana elevator was trading at $8.55 a bushel. Malt barley at $8.55. Feeder barley is actually about 5 1/4. A bushel. More than likely, this is closer to the feeder type than to the malt type that we grow today. So she collected, if I give her the benefit of the doubt on the malt barley, she collected about $5 worth of food. About 3/5 of a bushel would, in our day, be about $5 worth of food. Could you live on that? Can you live on $5 worth of food? You spend more than $5 yesterday on what you ate? I bet you did. Now, not only is that $5 worth, but it is highly likely that it lasted multiple days. In fact, some commentators note this might be enough grain for 2 to 3 weeks worth of food. 20 dry quarts could last you for 20 days if you ate just a quart of it a day between the two of them. So the point I'm making with that is that from our perspective, it doesn't look like a lot, but from hers, it's huge. It's huge. It's a mammoth amount based on what a normal gleaner would be able to glean in a day. In fact, I think the reason why this total is included in the text is because it seems reasonable to conclude that her total was significantly higher than what other gleaners would have collected. That's the point. I think that's the point the author's trying to make. With Ruth gleaning ahead of the others under the kindness of Boaz, she was able to collect a lot more than would be typical of a gleaner working around the edges of a field in the course of time. You'll also notice that Naomi's response in verses 18b and 19 seems to imply a bit of surprise on her part. We'll come back to that in a moment. Let me also point out something to you. You may not have made the connection. The amount she gleaned was another act of the providence of God. The amount that she gleaned was another act of the very providence of God himself. Think about it this way. What fell from the sheaves clearly would have been dictated by the providence of God moment by moment. As those ladies are bundling up those stalks of grain and collecting them and tying them together and hauling them to a central place to be threshed, some of the grain would have fallen off. How much would have fallen off would have been entirely the providence of God. There are no random events in this world. What takes place is ordained by God. Even how much grain falls from the sheaves in the process of harvesting them. So once again, we see the providence of God working in her life. And the providence of God in this case is also a great kindness because she is able to glean much more than what would be considered normal. It also says she takes it back into the city. That city, of course, is Bethlehem, to where she and Naomi are living. Now, it is implied in what I read that this grain is given by her to Naomi. She gives it to her mother-in-law, probably for her to make bread from it. Now, I'm arguing for that perspective because I suspect that Ruth is thinking to herself like this. Naomi, I'm going to give you the grain tomorrow. You make the bread. I'm going to go back to the field and collect more. So it makes reasonable sense that she would hand it over to her for her to turn it into edible food. She also, Ruth is, also gives to her mother-in-law what food she had left over after being satisfied. Now, you may be thinking, what is that about? Well, you remember when Ruth was in the process of gleaning that when lunchtime came, that Ruth was invited to sit with the reapers and to eat. And you remember in that text that tells us that she ate until she was satisfied of the roasted grain and the bread and the wine and everything else that was there. She had opportunity to eat that, but she could not finish all that she had. So she stuck it in her pocket. Just stuck it in her pocket. She took a few pieces of bread that she had left over and she put them into her pocket and she did not eat them the rest of the day. She took them home and gave them to her mother-in-law. Now you will notice that her intention all along, go all the way back to chapter 1 and verse 16, that her intention, as she herself said it, was to take care of her mother-in-law, to take care of Naomi. Where you go, I will go. Where you die, I die. Where you're buried, I'm buried. I'm taking care of you. So she even goes so far as to take the leftovers of her lunch and put them in her pocket, and instead of snacking on them during the course of the afternoon, she leaves them in there until sundown when she brings them home and gives them to her mother. That's the kind of commitment that this young girl has to this woman. She's eaten. She's been satisfied. She's full. But she takes some more to her mother-in-law, and she doesn't hold back anything. Again, the entire purpose of her going to glean from the field was to feed her mother-in-law. Naomi needed food. So we get a glimpse again into the character of this young girl and to who she is, and I think what the Lord is doing through her. A concept we'll come back to when we get to the next chapter of this book. Now look at verses 19 and 20. And her mother-in-law, that is Naomi, said to her, "Where did you glean today, and where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." Now, we'll just stop there. Ruth comes and lays out what she has gleaned, and along with the food that she has in her pocket. And the natural question that comes up is, well, where did you get all of this? Where did you glean today? In other words, where did you manage to find such success? I think that's the phrase of the question. I think what Naomi is doing is going, wow, this is spectacular. Where in the world did you manage to find such success? I think the phrase, "blessed be the man who took notice of you," is probably best interpreted as, someone surely was kind to let you stay in their field and glean so much. Somebody certainly took kindness upon you. That seems to be the point. Now, again, it's not, did someone specifically see you and put you in a special position before others? It's not what she's asking, because that would not be the assumption, right? The assumption would not be from Naomi, well, somebody must have taken some sort of special kindness upon you. No, more likely what she's simply thinking is, well, somebody was kind to let you stay in the field. Now, I want you to notice something here. I'm going to make a big point out of this as we go along. Naomi is not yet making the connection of Boaz as a redeemer. In the first statement, she's not going quite there yet. Okay, you'll follow my logic as we go. Now, Ruth answers this question by telling Naomi the name of the field owner. It was Boaz, some guy named Boaz, so let me do this. Now, as I said before, and I think I made a case about this back in verse 1, is that Naomi did not specifically send Ruth to this field. Remember, we looked at the evidence in this chapter that says that more than likely what happened is that Ruth went out to glean in a general sense and happened, I mean, that's the word that's used, happened into the field of Boaz. By the providence of God, she was led to that place. But it wasn't Naomi that specifically sent her to the field. As I said, verse 1 is an insertion by the author for the reader, just so we know who this Boaz is as the story unfolds. But that information is not in Ruth's mind and Naomi's mind when Ruth goes out to glean. So it's not an indication of some sort of familiarity by Naomi and Ruth. So the question that she's asking here, I think, is not a question of, well, did Boaz give you everything that he was supposed to? No, it was, where did you go and have such success? How is it possible that you, a widow, could glean this much from a field in one day? Somebody must have taken some sort of look upon you. So Naomi responds to the success of Ruth first with a question. Where did you get all this? But then it's followed with an exclamation. Okay? The explanation is, may he be blessed of the Lord. Okay, verse 20. After Ruth tells Naomi the name of the man, he says, well, may he be blessed by the Lord. In other words, an expression of great gratitude. Okay? Now, let me look closely at something. I want you to notice something technical here for a moment. It says, may he be blessed by the Lord, comma, whose kindness is not forsaken living in the dead. Now, there's a problem in that verse, and the problem is this. Who exactly does the word whose refer to? Whose kindness? Okay? Because if you read the sentence, you can come to the conclusion that either she's giving Boaz the credit for the kindness, or she's giving God the credit for the kindness. So it's a question that is plagued some as they read this particular verse. It's somewhat ambiguous. Now, here's how I'm going to interpret it. Okay? So here's my ever so humble opinion. Naomi is actually giving credit to God here, even though she is certainly grateful to Boaz. All right? Let me give you a couple of reasons why I think so. Number one, the whose is a conjunction that separates two nouns, and because the noun Lord is closest to the word whose, it seems likely that it's an immediate connection. So the whose going back to the immediate person before this. So that would be one evidence of that. Secondly, you remember that Naomi has previously complained that God had forsaken her, right? I take you back to chapter 1. What is Naomi's response to the women of the village when she arrives back in Bethlehem? Well, God has sent me away full, and now I've come back empty. I got nothing. And we talked about her whining back in chapter 1, verses 20 and 21, even going so far as to say, don't call me Naomi anymore. Call me Mara. Because I got nothing. Ruth is standing there going, me? But I think the reason why God is the one that's getting the great gratitude here is because of exactly that sentiment. Now she comes back to this village, and 24 hours later, she has all of this food in front of her that will last her for a few weeks. And a girl, Ruth, who's willing to go and work like this, and on top of that, somebody out there who is kind to her to allow her to have all of this, I think the response is, well, maybe I was wrong in complaining about God. Maybe I really should have been grateful to God. Her attitude here, to me, seems like a mirror to that sentence, to that sentiment. Before, God has forsaken me. Now, God has remembered me. Thirdly, because Naomi gives credit for this as a kindness to both the living and the dead. Okay? It's an important phrase. Now, it is certainly, what Ruth has accomplished is certainly a kindness to the living. Her, right? Ruth. But it is also a kindness extended, in quotation marks, to the dead. It is a kindness that has been extended in the sense that someone is showing kindness to the descendants of a deceased individual. Ruth has lost a husband. Naomi has lost a husband. They're both have someone in their past that was important to their survival that is deceased. So this individual, whoever it is showing kindness to both the living and the dead. And so I think it's God showing such a kindness to both the living and the dead. God is showing kindness to Elimelech, even though Elimelech's dead. But he's showing kindness to Elimelech because God is taking care of his widow, taking care of his family, something that the dead man can't do anymore, right? It seems most logical to me then that Naomi is actually giving gratitude to God because really, if you think about it, it's only God who can do a kindness for the dead. Yes, I suppose Boaz is being kind to the family of Elimelech by virtue of his extension, or by extension through Ruth, I get that. But it seems likely that it's really more of a gratitude to God as thinking of the dead. Now, I'm not suggesting that Naomi isn't grateful to Boaz, too. I mean, certainly she is. But I think this particular sentence is more a matter of her realizing, wait a minute, maybe God hasn't forsaken me after all. Maybe God is in fact working and doing and being kind to me. And this Boaz was the instrument through which God could be kind to both the living and the dead. That's how I would interpret the phrase. And I would build this principle out of it then. God works his kindnesses through the secondary means of people going out and showing his kindness to others. God works out his kindness in the world through the secondary means of people like you and I going out and being kind to others, and the kindness of God is flowing out through them. Which then adds this to the principle. Therefore, our motivation to be kind, the why we should be kind to others, ought to be as a testimony to the goodness of God as God. Okay? Now let me make sure you understand what I just said. Our motivation to go out and be kind is not simply because we're commanded to do so. That's a very good reason to be kind. But it's not the primary motivation that ought to drive us to our kindness towards others. Rather, we ought to be kind to others because God, by his nature, is kind. We want to proclaim his kindness through our testimony of kindness. The whole point of us being kind to others isn't to earn something for ourselves, although I think many people think that's the primary reason for doing so. And many Christians think that the primary reason we're supposed to be kind is, well, because God commanded us to do it. Well, we should be kind. I'll grit my teeth and do it. But in point of fact, there's a very real reality we have to consider, and that is this. The reason that we are motivated to go out and to be kind is because we want to go out and testify to the very kindness of God himself. We could extend this argument across a whole raft of the character of God. Do we go out and evangelize simply because we're commanded to do it? Or do we go out and testify to the grace of God as God is a God of grace? There's a very real difference between those two things. The reason why the vast majority of Christians do not, in fact, ever speak of their faith to others in any sort of evangelistic way is because they really don't get the idea of the grace of God. To them, it's just a rote exercise in obedience that needs to be done. And they'll quit after a while because they'll realize, I'm not having much success at this, so there's really no reason to do it. The real motivation for our behavior as followers of Christ is our recognition of who this God is. as we think about the moral and evangelistic and practical matters of life, we should be asking ourselves, who is this God? And that would give us the answers as to how we are to deal with various matters, including being kind, dealing with government authorities, and the list goes on and on. Why? I mean, even Jesus himself said this. In Matthew chapter 5, he says the following words. And I have found it, by the way, if I might just insert a little parenthetical note here. I have found that Alan seems to be reading my outlines ahead of time and making sure that these verses are quoted in his Sunday school class every week before I get a chance to do so. I'm not sure how you're doing that, but here's what Jesus says. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. See that? It doesn't say, Jesus doesn't come and say, do your good works so that they will praise you. No, he says, do your good works so that others will see the glory of God. How will they see that? They will see it through you. You will simply be nothing more than the prism through which God is seen by the world. And by the way, if you look closely at the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6 and 7, it's followed by a whole series of practical outworkings of that in reality. This is why Jesus will come along and say, love your enemy. It's counterintuitive to love your enemy, isn't it? But why would you love your enemy? Because God is a God of love who loves all men even though they're his enemy. We don't act as kind simply because we're commanded to. We go out and we show kindness because we reflect upon the nature of who this God is. We say, as God is kind, so I will be kind. And my friends, let me just point out something to you that may never have crossed your mind, but it should. The entirety of the Christian faith is built upon knowing who this God is. The Christian faith is not built on a whole series of commands that you have to follow. I know there's a lot of Christians who think that's how the church ought to work. You come in, the pastor gives you a list of all the things you're supposed to do and not to do, and you go out and do those things, and you'll be a good Christian. That is not going to survive. No. Christianity is about knowing who this God is. When Paul speaks of maturity in Ephesians 4 and other places, he's talking not about maturity in terms of behaving well. He's talking about maturity in knowing this God, understanding the nature and character of this God. The primary illiteracy of the church of our day isn't a lack of obedience to rules. The true illiteracy of our day is not really knowing who this God is. Who is it that we really worship? Who is this Jesus? What many will do, of course, is make up an image of him in their own mind and then worship that and follow that. But the true follower of Christ says, I want my life to be built upon the foundation of knowing who this God is. Who is this God? What is his nature? What are his plans and purposes? What has he done that flows out of his nature? That is what gives you a foundation to survive when the persecution comes. Because if your faith is only built on practicing certain things, you can easily dispose of those when the pressure comes. We are to know this God. His kindness comes through us because he is kind. Because he's been kind to us. Because he has fed us, he has clothed us, he has saved us. We should be kind because we know who he is. So Naomi responds to the success of Ruth first with a question. Okay, where did you go? And then secondly with an exclamation, man, that is great. What a wonderful thing. But then, thirdly, she responds with a revelation. She responds with a revelation. She says, the man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers. Now, you might say that she makes a connection here. Just for a moment, let me describe what we're talking about here, because it's going to be important as the rest of the book unfolds. What is this concept of a redeemer? What is a redeemer? As the term is being used here in this time frame, a redeemer is someone who can recover, redeem property belonging to a family member that is now in the possession of another. A redeemer is someone who can come along and restore the property of an individual back to its owner, rightful owner. Okay, when I say rightful owner, I mean rightful in terms of the law. Now let me just think through this. It is highly likely that Elimelech was forced to sell his land during the famine that's noted in 1:1 to support his family, right? And what would be the first thing you would do if a famine showed up? Well, you're eventually going to run out of your own food store, so you're going to have to sell something, and one of the things you have to sell eventually is your land. In fact, if you look at later on when we're in this series in Genesis, you're going to see that the Egyptians all sold their land to Joseph because there came a point when they ran out of money to buy grain from him, and so they eventually had to even sell him their land in order to survive. Joseph became the single greatest landowner in Egypt in that time. So it's highly likely that Elimelech was forced to sell his land. When it became obvious that he couldn't buy it back, he left. He took his family and he moved to Moab. He probably figured that there would be some place that he could go in Moab, maybe find a small plot of land, grow something, and survive. I don't know what his thinking was. It doesn't tell us. What we do know, however, is that he stayed there for 10 years. And it is highly likely, as we pointed out at the beginning of the book, that the reason that he stayed in Moab for 10 years is because there was nothing to come back to. The land was not his. He couldn't come back to it. Somebody else owns it now. He left. If he came back, there's nothing. In fact, this is exactly what Naomi is saying when she complains to the women of the village. I went back full, now I come back empty. I got nothing. I'm not coming back to anything. I'm only coming back because there's the possibility I could survive here. Maybe someone in Bethlehem will take kindness upon me. See the foreshadowing there? Now, Israelite law assumed that land was essential for survival. Okay, that should just go without saying. In agrarian society, you have to have land in order to grow crops and survive. And that land, according to the law, must remain connected to a family for its continued survival generation over generation. The law made it clear that you didn't just send your land off to someone else. You carried it from generation to generation, because when the father tilled the land and grew crops, he handed it over to his son who tilled the land and grew crops and handed it over to his son and so on down the line, because each successive generation would need to do that in order to survive. Remember, this is not a centralized society like we have in our day. This is a very localized society where people survived quite literally on what was right outside their door. So Israelite law provided a means by which a man could redeem back his property if he was forced to sell it during times of trouble. The law specifically gave recourse for this. In Leviticus chapter 25, verses 23 to 25. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the country you possess, you shall allow a redemption of the land. If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. Now you'll notice that the law is quite specific, and what we're seeing here in this book eventually is that law being put into place. All right, now we'll come back to that, of course, when we get to the next chapters. But I want to just pause for a moment and notice something here. Notice when I quoted the verse, "The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine." Now, who's speaking those words? No, God is speaking those words, right? He's speaking to Moses to write this down. The land is mine. In fact, he goes on to say, "You are strangers and sojourners with me." Okay? The concept of redemption is based on universal ownership by God. The concept of redemption is based on universal ownership by God. In the theocracy of this particular time, the land belonged to God and was only owned, quote unquote, by humans by extension. God says, look, this land of Canaan that I'm giving you to live in, it's mine. It belongs to me. And I get to decide who lives there. And I've decided that I don't want all these various Canaanites living there. I want my chosen people to live in this land. So I'm going to let you go and push them out. This is my land. So now when you stake a claim somewhere in this territory, don't think you're staking a claim that you own it. No. It belongs to me. I'm going to allow you the stewardship of that particular spot, but I'm not giving it to you. You're not taking ownership of it. Now, we could make the obvious application from that, right? Everything you own belongs to whom? Belongs to God. Everything on this planet belongs to God because He made it to begin with, right? The fact of the matter is that it belongs to Him. Thus, we should be generous, kind with what we have because it isn't ours anyways. So we should be always looking to ask, what would you, O Lord, wish to do with what you own? I'm just the steward of it. Okay, I could preach a tithing series right about here, but I'll just leave it at that. But here's where I really wanted to go with this. I want you to think about this. Redemption is based on universal ownership by God. Now extend that into the New Testament. New Testament redemption in Christ is based on the exact same principle. Christ redeems those who belong to Him, who are included in Him by the Father as part of His plan, the Father's plan. God owns all men, all right? We all answer to God. We all have our life and breath and live and breathe in Him, right? But He has a specific ownership of a people that He has set aside to Himself. And those people, because they belong to Him, He redeems them. He redeems them. The real difference here of understanding is this. Look, God doesn't just offer salvation to the whole wide world and hope that people accept it. No, God has a specific people that He has given to His Son. In eternity past, He wrote their names in the book of life. And He said to His Son, will you go and take on their estate and die in their place? And He said, I will go. And so when He comes, He brings with Him all of those who are included in Him. So that when He lives and dies, we who belong to Him live and die with Him. He owns a people. He knows them by name. They belong to Him. And therefore, He can redeem them because He owns them. The concept of redemption is based on a universal ownership by God. So what we're going to see here, cat out of the bag time, Boaz is going to be presented in this light. All right, we'll get that in the next chapter, Lord willing. Now, going back to the statement that Naomi makes. The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers. Okay, another opinion time here. I'm always open to debate on these if you want to debate me, but you better bring the text. I am convinced that the statement of Naomi here is actually a new revelation. It's something that comes to her recollection as she feels the kindness of Boaz under the kindness of God. Ruth comes home, drops this 20 quarts of food in front of her and a few crusts of bread that she has left over from lunch. Naomi goes, where'd you get all this? And Ruth says, well, I went to the field of Boaz. Wow. Man, this is awesome. This is great. This is a tremendous kindness. Look what God has done. God hasn't forsaken me. God has done great things to me. Hey, wait a minute. I don't know if she slapped her head or not. And that hurt, by the way. But I think this is a new revelation to her. I think this is something that comes to her in the moment. It's like, oh, hey. Now, where does that come from? God poking her in the ribs, maybe? Okay. Now, I understand Naomi knew of the family position of Boaz all along as a distant relative. She would have known that. That's obviously why she recognizes him, because she knew that. But I think she only now makes the connection that he could act as a redeemer. Here's what I think. The kindness she has experienced opens her eyes to a new possibility. A moment ago, or earlier in the day, she's sitting at home in the dark, complaining about the fact that God has abandoned her. Now all of a sudden, when Ruth shows up with this great bounty of food, she goes, maybe God hasn't abandoned me after all. And it's in the process of that that a recollection comes to her mind. The kindness of God does something in her. And it fills her and Ruth with a new perspective. In fact, I would argue that the remaining conversation that takes place in the rest of the chapter is based on that perspective. It's based on that perspective. How Ruth and Naomi speak in the moment, or continue, they do so as though there is more to be gleaned in the days ahead. Some of you got that. Others of you will get it this afternoon. So here's the rest of the conversation. Listen to Ruth in verse 21. Besides, he said to me, you shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest. What is she saying? Well, that's a very real possibility. You know what? If this Boaz is in fact a redeemer, guess what he said to me? He's already invited me to continue to glean behind the reapers. Maybe this means he will do something even greater in the future. He's already told me to stick around. Maybe you're right. Maybe there's more to it than this. Maybe Ruth herself has seen this. His generosity toward me might indicate a willingness to do even more. I think that's the way to interpret what she says. It's not just news, but rather a revelation. And Naomi responds to that. She says in verse 22, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with these young women, lest in another field you be assaulted. Now, again, remember that word assaulted here probably doesn't mean in some sort of sexual sense, but rather a sense in which if you go to another field, some other field somewhere, you're going to be physically ejected. Because if you go there, the reapers are not going to want you around. You're certainly not going to have the opportunity to glean the way you have been in this particular field. And they might throw you out. I think that's what it means. I don't think this is some sort of nefarious activity. I think this is Naomi saying, listen, if you go to some other field, there's a good possibility you're going to get booted out. In this one, you're not. In this one, you're not. So accept the generosity of Boaz and stick close to his workers. I mean, he's already been kind to you. Maybe he'll be kind to you in even greater measure once the harvest is over. Stay with them and see what happens. You see how that... See, I'm convinced that Naomi comes to this revelation of understanding who this Boaz is. She makes the connection. And that's how the two women respond. Well, yeah, if he really is a redeemer, if he really can save us, then guess what? He's already told me to stick around. And Naomi says, that's right, so stick around. So stay close. I think that's the best reading of this the last two bits of conversation. They're recognizing who this Boaz can be. Which leads me to this. What do you get when you cross the providence of God with the kindness of God? What do you get when you cross the working of God in the world to bring about His purposes, His providence, with His kindness, His desire to do good over His own? What do you get when you cross the providence of God with the kindness of God? The answer is, you get hope. You get hope. The combination of providence and kindness is the foundation of hope. God working in the world to accomplish His goals in the world, not some sort of random world in which we live, but God purposing to do what He wills, combined with the fact that He's doing so out of great kindness and using even the kindness of people, put those two things together and you have two women in the last two statements who are standing on their tiptoes and going, we have hope! We have hope! There's a future! There's a possibility! There's something good that might come! You see, to hope means to believe that God, in His kindness, is working out everything around us to perfect goals. That God is working out everything around us to perfect goals. Oh, I know, we don't see it. I know, you don't see it. You look at your life and the stinky mess that you're having to deal with, and you're thinking to yourself, how can this possibly be good? But God is using all things together for good. And so he's working in his providence and in his kindness to perfect goals. To reject that God is at work, or to blame God in our bitterness, dare I say Naomi, is to lose hope. See, there's no hope if the world around us is just random. There's no hope. The circumstance that befell you this week, the major disaster that befell you, it's just random. It just happens. Que sera, sera. Right? No. That is hopelessness. And there's far too many so-called believers today who are running around the world thinking, well, everything's just happening at random and God's just kind of watching and he's going to try to make the best of it. No. That's hopelessness. That's hopelessness. Hope is to look into the situation and say, I know that God is working this for a reason. He has a purpose behind us. And then we're to couple that with kindness. To recognize that God is actually being kind to us. Instead of becoming bitter over our circumstances, which is exactly what Naomi did, instead of becoming bitter over the realities, is to realize, wait a minute, God is good. And he does what is good. This may not look good to me now, but he has a purpose behind it that is good, that is going to his purposes in me. If we lose the fact that God is at work, or we blame God in our bitterness, we walk away without hope. We don't have any way to give hope in the world. Here's how Paul said it in 1 Timothy 4. Remember this verse? For to this end, meaning godliness through training, godliness being the end, for this end we toil and strive, because we have our hope set on the living God, who is the Savior of all people, especially of those who believe. We have our hope set not in what might happen and the hope that something bad doesn't happen, but our hope is set on the knowledge that our God is working in time and space to accomplish his purposes, alongside of the fact that he is perfectly kind and good in all that he does. You put those things together and you have hope. You have a reason to get out of bed in the morning. Don't lose your hope. Know that God is busy. He is working. I think Naomi sees it now. I think Ruth sees it now. And you read the last paragraph of this chapter, what you see is, we have hope. We have hope. So let us be a people of hope. Let us be a people who see the providence of God and his kindness and stand up and go, I don't know what tomorrow brings, but I know this, Christ is seated on his throne. Christ is authority over all things, and he will rule and reign. And in the end, all things will be worked out according to the counsel of his will to perfection. This world be cast aside.